Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. As has been said, this show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now, you may or you may not agree with things that are said, but if you keep an open mind, you'll be able to see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight it's my honor to bring back Dr. Bernie Siegel, prominent author and cancer specialist who had appeared on our show last year. And he does prefer to be called Bernie. He was born in Brooklyn, and he attended Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College. He holds membership in two Scholastic Honor Societies, and he graduated with honors. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He retired from practice as a clinical professor of surgery at Yale of General and Pediatric Surgery in 1989 to speak to patients and their caregivers. In 1978, he originated Exceptional Cancer Patients, a specific form of individual and group therapy utilizing patients' drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. It's based on carefrontation, a safe, loving, therapeutic confrontation which facilitates personal lifestyle changes, personal empowerment, and healing of the individual's life. The physical, spiritual, and psychological benefits which followed led to his desire to make everyone aware of his or her healing potential. He realized exceptional behavior is what we are all capable of. Bernie and his wife and co-worker Bobby live in a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut. They have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. They have co-authored their children's books and articles. Their home, with its many children, pets, and interests, resembles a cross-section between a family art gallery, museum, zoo, and automobile repair shop. It still resembles these things, although the children are trying to improve its appearance in order to avoid embarrassment. Well, that's what adult children like to do, isn't it, Bernie?
Yes, and, you know, I actually tell people to embarrass your children regularly. For two good reasons. It'll give them stories to talk about when you're ready to leave your body and move on. You can say, hey, kids, tell me what you remember. And as my father did, he died laughing, you know, listening to stories my mother was telling about their crazy first dates in which he lost the coin toss and had to take her out. But the other was that, you know, embarrassing your children, I always say, when you have 5 of them, saves you a fortune. Because I'd say, hey, Mom and I are going out to dinner. We'll eat what's in the refrigerator. Why? Because I'd go to a Chinese restaurant, order Italian food. You know, the waitress would say, how's everything? I said, why are you upsetting me? Did you hear the news? You know, why don't you ask me about the meal, not how's everything? And after a while, they say, we don't, you know. But, and these things really happen. From school and from work, they came home. Thank you, Dad. What did I do? Well, I did something that upset people at work today, but I didn't run into any problems because all people said was, well, you know who his father is? And the same thing happened at school. The teacher, you know, one of our sons did something crazy at school. He said, eh, it's okay. All the teacher said was, you know who his father is. So they didn't get punished because they had inherited my genes, you know, and everybody in town knows that I'm not normal. I mean, they even had Chinese food in an Italian restaurant for me one night, and the whole restaurant was roaring with laughter because I came in, I said, is my Chinese food ready? You know, and the waitresses who don't know me think I'm nuts, but the owner got used to it. So they had containers of Chinese food.
Well, oh, geez.
They really got me that night. But anyway,
well,
I don't
you
want
know,
to
who wants
from any program you want to cover. But as I say, that
no,
keeping
don't
the
worry
child
about it. I
alive,
love stories.
All right, you know, keeping the child
humor
alive
is great.
Is really what's vital. And then people begin to enjoy you coming in because they know you're going to be silly. You'll make them feel better. And it's not rude silliness, if you know what I mean, but just like a kid having fun. And I feel better, they
mm-hmm.
feel better. You know, you stay young that way and move on. So
that's one of my missions in life is to wake people mm-hmm. up to their sense of humor. I think that, like the Reader's Digest says, humor is, or laughter is the best medicine. And
yeah.
it sounds like you inherited your father's sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, he who laughs, lasts. My wife used to do stand-up one-liners. I always said, like a female Henny Youngman. You know, that was one of her finishing lines. He who laughs, lasts. And a study of cancer patients showed that those who laughed for no apparent reason, you know, they were told every 3 or 4 hours, laugh. They had a better survival rate than those who didn't laugh for no reason. You know, when you look at them a few years later, those who laughed felt better and lived longer. And everybody knows that. When you laugh, oh, a friend of mine, he did a video of Patch Adams, myself, and a bunch of other people about laughter. And I always remember I had a lady in total panic coming into the operating room, and I literally stood in the hallway for close to an hour trying to calm her down because I was afraid, you know, she might have a heart arrhythmia or something if she was in this kind of panic. But nothing I said helped her. We wheel her into the operating room, and she looks around, you know, with that fear in her eye and says, thank God, all these wonderful people are going to take care of me. In my head, I'm thinking, if I agree with her, what the hell is that going to accomplish? So the kid in me says, I've worked with these people for years. They are not wonderful people. And you know, for a moment, I thought she was going to run down the hall. But everybody in the operating room knew Siegel. You know what I mean? They know I'm kidding. So they all burst out laughing, and she starts laughing, and the fear is gone. Well, another example.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful.
When you're laughing.
You know, I once heard that children laugh a couple hundred times a day and that the average adult just laughs 6 times a day. What do you think is the reason for that? Why is it that so many of us out?
We're thinking.
We take life too seriously.
Yeah, the kids are feeling.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
See, when you ask, let me give you 2 specific examples. One, you see, because the 90-year-old becomes like a kid again. So I had a patient who was in her 90s, cancer and a whole bunch of other problems. But I knew, because she, in her house, she rented out rooms to college students. And they loved being there because she was, again, like a mother, you know, with a lot of wisdom. And I asked her to come to our cancer support group. I said, because you're filled with wisdom and you can just share. And she would sit there, usually not saying anything. But one day, the room again, filled with fear. What's going to happen to me? And what's this? I didn't know what the hell to do. I mean, I knew, you know, intellectual words are not going to solve anything. So I turned to her. I said, what are you afraid of? And after close to 3 or 4 minutes had passed with silence, she said, oh, I know what it is. I said, what is it? Driving on the parkway at night. And then the room burst out laughing. You know, because here they are, and the only thing she's afraid of is driving on the parkway at night. And I think, again, it's that kind of release, you know, because she had lived through everything that everybody else is worrying about. And they realized they could survive, too. And that's why I use that word that you did in the introduction, your potential. What are you capable of? Stop being afraid of participating. you know, of failing, losing the battle. It's participating. That's the key. Stop being afraid and come on in here and let's see what happens. And again, though, well, another simple example of how the mind affects you. A new chemotherapy protocol was put together. There were four drugs in it. The first was etoposide that began with E, and the others were E, P, O, and H. I forget the names of the three other drugs, but it's spelled EPO, and they called it the EPO protocol. One of the doctors, however, noticed, hey, if I turn the letters around, it spells hope. And at the end of the study, those who called it EPO, 27% of the patients responded in a positive way. The doctor who called it hope had 73% of the patients respond positively. And all he did was change the name because he had to follow the same protocol they were following. And that's what's always impressed me, how powerful our mind is. I mean, there are many cases I know of as a doctor, because I'm trying to help the doctors involved, where medical errors were made and the patients were not given the treatment they were supposed to have. And the doctors didn't know it. This is what impressed me. And they were feeling terrible, but I made it clear to them that the reason they didn't know it was that all the patients acted as if they were being treated. I mean, you lie down on a radiation therapy, you know, under the machine, and you don't know you're not being treated. So what happens? Your skin gets red, your tumor shrinks. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, some of these doctors almost fainted when I pointed out to them the reason you didn't know is because all the patients acted as if they were being treated. You know, and then it was like, oh, my God, you're right. Yeah. But at least they didn't feel so guilty then, you know, about what had happened.
Well, you talked about that in a statement that you sent me, and I'd love to read that and use that as a vehicle for getting into the interview, especially along the lines of a person's ability to heal themselves, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
You wrote, if I were involved in the case of the young woman the court has ordered to have chemotherapy, it wouldn't be so big a problem. The mind is very powerful. And what it visualizes, the body believes. But there is an intuitive, unconscious wisdom which may not agree with what she thinks and feels. Dreams and drawings can reveal this inner wisdom and knowledge. I would ask her to draw a picture with crayons of herself receiving chemotherapy. And now here you talk about something that you just referred to. Some people who do not want chemotherapy draw it as golden energy flowing to their cancer. I'm sorry, that's in the next paragraph. It is right for them, but their fears and the doctor's frightening words about the side effects are the problem. Others who choose it wonder why they are not doing well. Their drawing of chemo is the devil giving them poison. No wonder they have a problem, and this holds for drawings of surgery, radiation, and eating vegetables as your treatment. Now, here's a statement I find interesting. I know of many cases where, due to medical errors, patients did not receive the radiation, surgery, or chemo they thought they were receiving, but the doctors didn't realize it until routine inspections were made because all the patients were reacting as if they were being treated with tumor shrinking and side effects. Doctors' words are hypnotic, and words can become sword words which kill or cure. You change your image by visualizing what you desire, and Bernie says he's created CDs for people entitled Getting Ready so they could prepare themselves and their bodies by seeing everything going beautifully after treatment. Their dreams, drawings, and response to treatment all improve, and they can eliminate side effects. Now, that certainly speaks to the power of the mind over matter. And, I mean, you're a big proponent of the fact that it is actually the patient that heals themselves and that the doctor facilitates the process. And what I find amazing... Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people are given death sentences by their doctors and they die. Right. What makes a doctor give a bleak prognosis to somebody and take away their hope.
How we're trained, but we're not trained. That's the problem, to care for people. I mean, a sentence that says it well is, doctors treat the result, not the cause. See, they're treating a disease. And something that has made me a little bit happy recently, way back in the mid-1990s, I wrote to the American College of Surgeons because I found it unbelievable that a surgeon had written them, you know, like a letter to the editor into the journal saying, is it policy to talk to family members after you operate on somebody? I thought, what is this man, a total idiot? You operate on a family member and you leave them, you know, without knowing anything about what's going on? And the other was that the pledge is, I will deal with my patients as I would wish to be dealt with if I were in the patient's position. I said, hey, if I buy a car, I expect to deal with somebody. I go to a dealer. But if I'm having an operation, I'd like to be cared for. How about changing those words? So they let me write an article, which was entitled Surgery, Mechanical or Healing Art. And they had a lot of trouble with the article and editing it and, you know, waiting months and probably wishing they'd never asked me to write an article. Here we are 25 years later, and the same journal had an article by young physicians, and it turned out all of them were women who won this contest. They were essays on the emotional aspects of being a physician and what they were feeling, see? And then they had an article on doctors dealing with death. I mean, doctors really use the word dead. I mean, you know, you failed, pass, we lost him, that kind of thing. But to see that they were actually at this time, 25 years later, publishing something at least says, hey, we're moving forward a little bit. But it is not a standard part of medical training. So when doctors have pain, you know, a patient dies, you make the wrong diagnosis. And I'm not talking about malpractice, but just, hey, you're related to all these patients and things happen to people. I mean, I found it incredibly painful. I loved children, did a lot of children's surgery. You know, why did God give kids cancer? If they'd have a complication after surgery, I felt terrible. And honestly, I said to many of them, I'm quitting. I can't take this. And they'd always give me a hug and say, you're not quitting. Because they knew I cared, and that was what was causing me the pain. So I learned to care for people. Matter of fact, that was a sentence that redirected my life. This is from one of my patients. You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits. How many doctors teach people to live? And yet that's what survival is about. You know, again, more and more studies show you, like that HOPE study, that people with a specific personality are more likely to be survivors. I have that on my website called An Immune Competent Personality, put together by a psychiatrist, George Solomon, who was treating AIDS patients, you know, decades ago, before there was any treatment when the first, and he could see that it made a difference what they were like and what their personality was like. And there are it's in the psychology journals, not in the medical journals. I mean, I wrote articles for medical journals trying to help. They came back saying, interesting, but it's not appropriate. So I sent it to appropriate psychology and, you know, psychiatry journals. Yes, it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. We know all this, so we're not publishing your article. That blew my mind, you know, that nobody, again, had trained me to what I thought I was discovering, working with drawings and emotions and, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and a lot of others who became my teachers and awakened me to so many things. And medicine, I always say, becomes like an electrician and a plumber. If the plumber's in your house, you don't say, can you check, you know, this fixture that isn't working? And he says, no, I'm not an electrician. And so doctors have become so specialized, they're not treating a whole person. You know, it's like if it's a house, they're treating their specific problem. And I don't know about that, you know, whatever else is going on. But human beings are not like physical structures, like a house. You know, they're unified. Mind and body are one. Our emotions become our chemistry. Hey, I'm always saying, and it's true, Monday morning, more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. So you can predict who will do well with the cancer purely from a psychological testing, and this has been done. And I learned to teach people survivor behavior. So,
that's,
you know,
what
I can
wondered.
Say to them, look, here's what the people who do well are like and why I started support groups to do that teaching. And I can tell you, the people who come to support groups that I'm running don't die when they're supposed to. And it's them. Please understand, you know, I'm not doing some magical, mysterious work. It's them. I'm the coach. But they're showing up for practice every week or two, see, and learning more and more. And it is quite amazing to watch that happen. But it's what keeps me doing it, because I know damn well, you know, they've got something special. And if the doctor is looking at statistics, people aren't statistics. Individuals aren't statistics. So when you're telling people, as one gentleman who's alive and well today was told, you have a 5% chance of living 2 years. Thank goodness he was getting his car fixed and went into a used bookstore, pulled my book off the shelf, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, read the whole thing, transformed his life, his cancer disappeared. And guess what? You'd think the doctor would say, what the hell did you do? The doctor said, I'm not interested. You know, it's like, what is wrong with you? Yeah. Mm. I mean, and I hear that very often. And see, here's the key to it. If you get well and you're not supposed to, you've had a spontaneous remission or a miracle. So if you went up to somebody and said, how can I have a spontaneous remission or a miracle? They say, I don't know. It's spontaneous, miraculous. But in Solzhenitsyn's book, Cancer Ward, he knows the truth because of his own personal life. It's described as one of the men says, oh, look, I found this book. There are cases of self-induced healing, not recovery through treatment. And the symbol that fluttered out of the book was a rainbow-colored butterfly. And that says it all. That's why
I love that.
The poets, the novelists, songwriters, they see life and they write about the truth. You see, the butterfly is transformation. The rainbow, your life is in order, harmony, rhythm. And every color literally has meaning. So you're getting all your emotions in order. And look what happens in your body then.
Let's talk now a little bit about emotion, the role they play in keeping one in a healthy, not just healthy frame of mind, but keeping their bodies healthy. Because
all right,
let me
interrupt you and give you a poem.
Go ahead.
See?
All right,
because
I'd love it.
This is just a perfect example. There's a poem called Miss G by W.H. Auden. The doctor in this poem examines a very lonely woman, diagnoses cancer. That night, he's home having dinner with his wife, and he says, cancer's a funny thing. Childless women get it, and men when they retire. It's as if there had to be an outlet for their foiled creative fire. Now, I said that at a medical meeting, and a doctor yelled, just because it rhymes doesn't make it true. See? Why is he fighting with me, arguing? It's a, you know? But see, when I talk about the decades going by, what do you think we know today? Loneliness affects the genes which control immune function. So a lonely individual is more susceptible to every disease versus a person who has multiple relationships. Now, just a couple of examples. I mean, women live longer than men with the same cancers. You'd say, well, why? Because the women are into, I can't die till you're all married and out of the house. You know, they're into relationships. And I've had men sitting in my office with wife and children next to them say, I can't work. What's the point of living? See? And in a study after a heart attack in Australia, the doctor looked up the people who had a dog in the house or didn't have a dog in the house. If you had a dog in the house, 5% of the people had died in the ensuing 12 months after the heart attack. No dog in the house, 26% had died. You know? So you'd say, you're damn right, relationships. Even plants. I mean, I won't get into all these studies, but when people were responsible in a nursing home for the plants in their room, they lived longer than the people across the hall who were told we're decorating your room.
Well, it seems that if you have a sense of purpose, you're more likely to thrive. And certainly wisdom seems to dictate that if you have a positive frame of mind, you're more likely to attract positive results. And negative frame of mind, the opposite comes true. I mean, I think in terms of people who have been victims who keep replaying the same tape over and over again and attract abusive relationships and the like, and become involved in things like addiction and that sort of thing. And people can break free of that. All they have to do is do some inner soul work and rewrite history. And it takes a lot of work, folks, but you can do it. You don't need to repeat the same negative patterns. You can break free by saying no and saying
Your term, rewrite history. I often say abandon your past. People have to realize they can rewrite their past. Because it's, see, one of the other statistics, Harvard students are asked, did your parents love you?
No.
Did your parents love you? Yes. When they looked them up 35 years after graduation, 98% of those who said my parents didn't love me had suffered a major illness. Of those who said, yes, my parents loved me, 24% had suffered a major illness. So, again, self-worth, self-esteem, care. I always say that information doesn't save lives. Inspiration does. You know, you have to want to use the information. You have to feel self-worth, self-esteem. But if you grow up with, you're a mess, you embarrass us, we wish you didn't have you, we want you to commit suicide. And I don't make up any of these lines or stories. I know the people who were told by their parents, we want you to commit suicide. And then the parents went and killed themselves. And I'm trying to get them to live. It ain't easy. But you see, even that rage within you leads to disease. You end up attacking your own body. So often with autoimmune diseases, it's related again to the lack of love, the resentment. Well, you know, we read the headlines. You go into schools, you go into places of employment, boom, 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 you kill everybody, and then you commit suicide. That's out of a desire for revenge. Because those people did not grow up with a reverence for life and love.
Well, resentment is certainly a poison, too, and that can lead to disease. It seems to me that any kind of negative emotion can set you up for physical disease. I think in terms of people I've known in my life who have had these kinds of problems who have become ill. I mean, we make ourselves physically ill, yet so many people want to just blame it on anything other than themselves rather than taking responsibility for themselves.
Well, they see it as guilt. And I try to point out to them, if I ask you about your life, it's not that I'm making you feel guilty. It's trying to get you to see what made you susceptible at a certain time. In other words, again, studies that are done. You have twin sisters. One is a sweet kid who internalizes anger and is always trying to please her parents. And the other is a little devil who's doing her thing and often drives her parents crazy. The one who's more likely to get cancer is the sweet little kid who's internalizing all her feelings and not expressing them, see, to please others. And those are things that, you know, it's scientific. We know it happens. And so does an audience. If you ask them which sister is more likely to get sick, everybody votes the good girl. Yeah. And so, again, we have to realize not to let others impose a life upon us. We have to live our own authentic life. And a lot of women become submissive, which is different than polite, and therefore feel they've lost their life. You know, now they're mama. And their life loses meaning when the kids leave home, and then they get into big trouble. So We have to have an independent, authentic life and give it meaning.
Well, I think that's why it's so important to detach from labels and outer conditions and to focus on what we have within ourselves, the strengths that we have within ourselves, spirit, if you will, and not attach ourselves to things of this world that can quite often be limiting, damaging, etc. You know, when you were talking about the importance of self-esteem, I was thinking about how Louise Hay helped me transform my life many, many years ago through the use of affirmation. And, of course, I talk about that in my latest book. But it's not enough to write out an affirmation. You have to claim it and say it as if you believe it. And you talk about the power of visualization. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you use that with your patients and with your clients to help them imagine a different set of circumstances for themselves and induce healing.
One thing, let me say that I agree with you 100% about the affirmations, because every morning I've got a long list of different ones that I've put together that come from various sources. You know, it can't come from Buddhism, Zen, psychology, or Siegel, you know, making something up himself. But I have a whole series, because my wife has had about 50 years worth of multiple sclerosis. So when we do a little exercising in the morning before we head to the kitchen, I repeat the mantra. And I know it makes me feel better and her feel and do better, you know, hearing all these positive words. And they work. Let me say that to people. It doesn't mean if you say them for 3 days, you're going to, you know, have a miraculous transformation. But if you keep it up, studies again show, after a few months, people who said, it's crazy, what point is saying that? How's that going to help? They all came in feeling better. And I know it works on me. I mean, it's not a placebo effect, you know. I know when I start in on it in the morning, it makes a difference. And I put it into these words, too, that if you start the day with what you're grateful for, you will feel very different than if you start the day, what am I worried about? What do I have to do today? And I had one other, and let me, excuse me to interject this, because I found it to be fun, that you take the letters of the alphabet, and on day one of every month, you think of three things you're grateful for that begin with the letter A. And then the next day, B, and I always say at the end of the month, you get a few days off. But you're not allowed to repeat the next month what you said the month before. And I found that, I mean, I would laugh in the morning. I'd go out, taking the dogs out for a walk, and go through my, okay, let's see, today's the letter L. What three things am I grateful for? And I would be struggling sometimes to come up with three new things. I mean, it could be Los Angeles, if you know. It didn't matter what it was, but something that began with L. And then I was laughing, thinking, look how hard you're working on gratitude. And I really loved it, you know, and the effect it had on me. So I would say, again, use the mantra and work on that. Now, the visual side, because there's two parts of the brain, you know, the visual and the auditory and verbal. I was an artist as a child, and, well, and still am, but so doing imagery and visualization really amazed me, because there are a lot of things I didn't believe in. They weren't part of my training. So when somebody says, we're going to do a guided imagery, it's like, oh, yeah, I came to hear a lecture, not close my eyes. But because of the visual person I am, I mean, what I saw was amazing, and I realized how powerful it was. So again, what do I say to people? Well, an example that's in my book, I believe, The Art of Healing, because I often show this slide. A lady said, I'm having surgery. I said, draw yourself in the operating room. It's a black box, and that's the only color she used, black. She's lying on a table with only two legs, and there's not a soul in the room. I said, if I were you, I wouldn't have surgery, or I'd get another surgeon. I mean, this is not a good picture. She said, no, I like the doctor. I said, look, if you want to go ahead, then you have to change your image. So every few hours, I want you to picture yourself getting in the car, going to the hospital, you know, getting ready, getting admitted, going to the operating room, waking up hungry, comfortable, feeling well, and home quickly. And a week later, she came in and handed me a picture. And it's gorgeous. I mean, there are four legs on the table. It's blue. There's a team of family, a team of doctors, all with the same color. Why I say team. There's a window in the operating room with God's light shining in. I mean, if that had been her first drawing, I would have said, just go ahead, don't worry. And even the nurses used to say to me, your patients refuse pain medication. I said, excuse me, did it ever occur to you they're not hurting? The nurses thought I was
mad.
But they realized what I was speaking was the truth. I mean, they'd say, hey, I'm a little sore, but I don't need narcotics. They'd go home quickly. And again, it was their attitude towards me, towards the surgery, and, you know, how they felt about it. But again, why does the picturing it, the imagery, work? Because your body doesn't know you're not having it done. So if you picture yourself four times a day having surgery and doing beautifully, by the end of a week, you've had 28 successful operations, and your body thinks, okay, so we're having 29 tomorrow. That shouldn't be a problem. All the others have gone well. And again, you know, it's like hypnotizing yourself. And if you use the negative side, which a lot of doctors, well, think about the commercials on television. After they tell you something will fix your headache, they tell you how it can sterilize you, destroy your liver, give you a heart attack or cancer. I mean, my God, you know, after you listen to that, oh, I'll keep my headache, thank you. And again, see, doctors tend to tell you that and not the good things. You know, yes, we're giving you this treatment. It can cause, you know, your hair to fall out, your heart to have... And they don't say, hey, but it could cure you. And again, the power of words. One more example, patient of mine. He was a Quaker, a conscientious objector. He went to see an oncologist. The oncologist said to him, I'm going to give you this treatment to kill your cancer. He said, I don't kill anything. I'm a conscientious objector. And he walked out of the office.
I like that.
Now, he didn't go home and die. He lived for over 12 years. But you see, if the doctor took care of a human being and not a disease, he could have said to him, Dave, I got something that's going to make you well. And I don't think, you know, Dave wouldn't have had any problem with that kind of image. Oh, it's going to make me well. Thank you. Not we're going to kill something. And again, if we are waging, I learned this from Mother Teresa, she said she'll attend the peace rally, but she's not going to attend an anti-war rally, which upset the people who were inviting her to an anti-war rally. But she pointed out to me, in my mind, that when we focus on killing, you know, the disease, the cancer, we're empowering the enemy, and we're in a battle, and we're giving the energy in the wrong place, when it should be into healing and creating a peaceful, loving life and loving our body as well. Because that's what I found too. I always say to people, love your life, love your body. Then it gets a message. You like living and it does what it can to keep you alive. But if you're getting up every day hating the world and your job and your traffic, your body will do you a favor. Monday morning, heart attacks, suicides, illnesses more often on Monday than any day of the week.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree more with you about the power of the word and the power of thoughts. They certainly can take one in whatever direction they want to go. And you talked in that statement that I read, you talked about the unconscious intuitive knowing, which I guess sometimes can run counter to whatever one might want to project. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, it's, you see, the intellect, you know, the thinking side. Should I do this? Should I do that? But what comes up in a dream? Think about it that way. You don't think about what I'm going to dream tonight. I mean, yes, you can program your head in a way on something that means is meaningful to you, but you don't go to bed and say, I think this is what I'll dream tonight, and this is how it'll come out. your unconscious takes over because your intellect is turned off. And then you're given the true inner wisdom. One of my books is called The Book of Miracles. What's one of the stories? Lady goes to sleep. In her dream, a dark-skinned woman with an accent appears and says, "You have a lump in your breast. You need to have it checked." She wakes up and her right breast has a lump. And at the hospital, they diagnose her with cancer and tell her that the doctor who's going to be caring for her will be coming into the room. And into the room walks a doctor from India, female, and it's a woman from her dream who comes in and is going to take care of her. Now, that's no
problem. Oh, wow, that's amazing.
See, what doctors get aren't told. Let me just, why I get mad at medicine. It's probably 100 years ago now that Carl Jung interpreted a dream and correctly diagnosed a brain tumor. I have never met a medical student who's ever been told that while in medical school. Why aren't we telling them that? So they ask their patients those questions.
Well, what I was going to say, I had on an amazing guest who is an author of a book, and I'm going to have to plead ignorance at the moment. I don't remember, but she had a dream where an angel came to her and told her she had cancer. She went to the doctor. He ran some tests and said, "No, you don't." This happened a second time. Once again, the doctor said, "No, you don't." So then the angel appeared to her the third time and told her exactly where it was, told her the exact words to use with the doctor, and tell him where to do the exploratory surgery. And lo and behold, they found cancer, and it was actually stage 4 cancer. I don't know how it's possible that the doctor couldn't have picked up on that. But this woman had a very positive outlook on life, and she not only survived, but she thrived. And I think that that's another important thing for people to consider, to get beyond just surviving, but to thrive. And I like what you were saying about gratitude earlier in the program. I think that gratitude is such an uplifting emotion or attitude, if you will. And I know I find that I need to count my blessings every day. I mean, something as simple as being able to walk, because I have had a period in my life when I was unable to walk. And I believe it's also the gateway to abundance of more blessings. But I would like to get into your book, The Art of Healing, that you mentioned. Of course, you're probably best known for Love, Medicine, and Miracles, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. I love the subtitle of your book, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. Would you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well,
just
what you
said. Pieces of it.
Yeah, just what you said a minute ago. When patients would come to me and say, they tell me my mammogram's okay, but I know it isn't. In other words, what's going on in my breast isn't okay. I would always biopsy them. And I can tell you, I had 100% results that when patients said, "I know there's a cancer there," no matter what the mammogram showed, they were right. So I learned to listen and to ask about dreams. So they weren't afraid of talking about it. Now, what got me really started on this was drawing a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross many years ago when I was having all kinds of emotional problems as a doctor, because I wasn't trained, as I say, to deal with the feelings. And I cared about people. I wasn't a doctor for mechanical reasons. Because, you see, when you talk about drawings, ask medical students and doctors, draw yourself working as a doctor. Most of the medical students didn't have a human being in the picture. They have a diploma, a desk, and themselves, you see. And to me, that's not being a doctor. It's a rare student, I mean, less than 5%, who draw themselves handing a tissue to a patient, you know, not applying instruments or doing something to them, but treating them as a human being. Oh, and there are many famous paintings with the same kind of thing, where the doctors are doing one thing only, thinking, the chin is in their hand, while dying children, patients, are right before them, and they're sitting and thinking instead of touching or holding. And that also can restore life. And I mean that literally. When a mother picks up a dying infant at the hospital, puts it against its bare breast, and the child begins to suckle on the nipple and came back to life. I mean, that's a true story. Yeah, that wakes the hospital up. But anyway, I could go on endlessly with stories. But what I drew for Elizabeth was an outdoor scene, and my inner guide that I met, a man named George, was sitting next to me. On my shoulder is a bird named Rainbow, and there's a pond in front of us with a fish out of water, leaping up. But what really struck me was Elizabeth saying, "Bernie, what are you covering up?" I said, "Why do you ask that?" She said, "Bernie, I gave you a white piece of paper to draw a picture, and you took a white crayon and made snow on the mountain. It's already white. You don't need another layer. What are you covering up?" And I knew it was my feelings. "Why is 11 important?" I said, "Well, I've been doing this work 11 months. Why did you ask?" "Because you drew 11 trees." And, you know, as she went through this, I realized, holy smokes, look at what's on the paper that I don't even know about or think about. But you realize, and I mean this literally, that our lives are stored within us. Well, the psychologist Alice Miller, "Our childhood is stored up in our bodies." And the end of that paragraph is, "And someday the body will present its bill." See, if we don't respond to what's stored in us. And I began to see this. There's one picture in the book in which a reporter came to see me who was very intellectual. And I thought, this is going to be an unpleasant interview. You know, it's her job. She didn't think much of me, but she, you know, was told to go interview him. I said to her, "Draw a picture, and after I'm done with my patients, I'll sit down with you and we'll talk." She came in with a picture. She's got a big head, which said to me, yes, she is very intellectual. She drew herself. But behind her was a clock with one hand on it pointed at the number 12. Now, the proper question would be, why is 12 important to you? You know, why is it significant in your life? But I thought, I got to shake her up. So I said, "What happened when you were 12 years old?" "Oh, I don't like deadlines." I said, "There's only one hand on the clock. What happened?" And then she burst into tears and told me she was sexually abused. See, another, this is from a doctor saying, "I've got a patient with pelvic problems. No matter what I do, I can't help her." I said, "Tell her to draw a picture." And she drew a broken heart.
Oh.
21 drops of blood coming out of it. I said, "Ask her what happened when she was 21. Turned out she was sexually abused. I mean, it was one of the most horrible emails I've ever read. What happened to her when she was 21. And again, see, now what's stored in her can be brought forth and help her to heal. So anyway, I started then meeting Jungian therapists and others who, you know, like sending the article to journals saying, yes, we know this. And I began to talk to them so I could learn more. And was thrilled that the New World Library took 60 drawings and put them in this book. Now, in my first book, there may be 6 or 8, you know, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, just to give people some idea. But most publishers don't want to put in lots of drawings. I guess it gets expensive. But here we have 60 drawings, and I discuss every one of them. Because, you see, if you know anatomy, that's a problem for art therapists. They're not trained in anatomy. So when I looked at a tree, I saw a brain. Or I can see bile ducts, a brain tumor, chocolate syrup on a strawberry cone. I mean, that's what the kids may say, you see, or the adults may say about their drawing. But I see the anatomy because I know anatomy. And that's the part that really got me to wake up and to use crayons at the hospital. See, the intuitive wisdom. The color, one of the outpatient operating rooms began to really see the value of getting the children to draw pictures before the operation. And they made a coloring book for the kids. Page one, it says, there's a picture of the operating room, the child sitting on the operating table, the anesthesiologist is next to them. And it says, "You will meet someone wearing green, what looks like green pajamas. He's an anesthesiologist. Now, the kids are to color the pages in. They're all blank, empty. But here it mentions a color. And the boy sits down, draws the anesthesiologist in red. And I said to the anesthesiologist, something's going on here. We got a problem. He said, yes, Bernie, your mother has muscular dystrophy. And if he has an abnormal gene, then muscle relaxants have the opposite effect on him. All his muscles could contract, create great body heat, and damage his brain. I said, then turn to the last page, because if he draws himself purple, a spiritual color, I'm canceling the operation, because he may be saying, I'm going to die in the operating room. And on the last page, he used red and black, where, you know, he's not happy and where the surgery was. So I said, okay, we don't have to worry. He'll go home, you know, unhappy that he had an operation, but he'll go home and be okay. And the color, I may add, purple. See, people will draw purple butterflies, kites, balloons going up in the air. I mean, one woman drew a purple kite with her husband holding it. And I said to her, you're ready to go, but he can't let go of you. You see, and we brought him in and said, look, your wife is ready. You can't let go. Yeah, he said, my wife's a nurse. She takes care of every damn thing at the house. She cooks, pays bills, does everything, takes care of her pets. If she dies, I'm dead. I don't know how to do a damn thing. And she said, well, then I won't die. I'll train you. And they went on for about 6 months until he said, okay, I've cut the string. And then she was free to go, you see. She didn't have to stay to train him anymore. But those are the symbols that help families, you know, especially if you're a parent and your child draws a purple balloon draped in black going out of the picture. And I said, take your child, the four-year-old, home and just love her. She's been through so much because of the cancer. There were a lot of colorful dots on the page. I said, I don't know what they mean. Well, a few weeks later, I got the phone call. Bernie, it's my birthday today. Amber woke up and said, Mom, I'm dying today to free you from all the trouble. It's your birthday gift, my dying today. And when we counted the dots, the colorful dots on the page, those were exactly the number of days that were left in her life.
Wow. Well, talk about intuitive knowing.
And that's hanging amazing. In my house, by the way, that the picture she
is
did.
Is it really?
Yeah, because the mother and I got so close. I mean, that child, she may have been 4 years old, but she was more like a 100-year-old philosopher. I mean, what she taught everybody about life, just this little 4-year-old.
Well, that's the amazing thing about a lot of these children that have horrific diseases is that they can teach other people so much about how to live and how to appreciate each and every moment that comes along. And that's what life is meant to be, is appreciation for the present moment, because we never know what's coming next.
Yep. And one of our children, when he was 7, told me he needed an x-ray. You see, intuitive, you got a 7-year-old. His father's a doctor, tells him to take a hot bath because he must have hurt his leg. He said, no, I need an x-ray. And he had a bone tumor. Now, again, just looking at the x-ray, it looked like a malignant tumor. You know, he'll lose his leg, he'll be dead in a year. You can imagine, this is before I had my life together, how I felt when I came home after seeing his x-ray. The next day, he came in to me, and I never forget this moment. Dad, can I talk to you for a minute? Yes, what is it? You're handling this poorly. I mean, I can't but laugh now, today, because here's a 7-year-old giving his father a lecture on we're trying to enjoy the day. You want us depressed in our room. We want to go out and play in the front yard. You know, he's alive today. It turned out to be an extremely rare benign tumor. I mean, it was, you know, one of those really fortunate things that happened. But he really became my therapist for that week, you know, teaching me how to live and how to enjoy the day and not thinking what's going to happen next year. And that's, you know, what I'm teaching people today. Who the hell knows about next year? I always say, if the doctor says you have 2 months to live and you say, well, I'm going to live 6, months, or I'll live 2 years. I'll bet you $10,000. The doctor doesn't say, oh, fine, I'll bet I can't lose. They say, well, I mean, that could happen. I'm not going to bet $10,000. Then why do you tell me? Because I know people have gone home and died in a week when doctors took their hope away. I mean, a man was refused cataract surgery by his health plan because he had cancer. And they said, you'll die soon. We're not going to spend money on cataract surgery. He went, climbed into bed, and died in a week. Yeah. Because the loss of vision was making his life, you know, an unhappy experience where he couldn't enjoy doing a lot of things.
Well, you know, this hour has gone very quickly. I wondered if you could tell us what you believe is the most important lesson a person could uncover in terms of coming to terms with healing themselves.
As I said earlier, I summarize it, love your life, love your body. Now, I also say, ask yourself how you want to contribute that love to the world also. So it's not, again, something imposed on you, but it's your way. See, a lawyer learns he has cancer, picks up his violin, which his parents told him they didn't want him to be a violinist. They wanted a lawyer. But when he learns he's going to die, he plays his violin and doesn't die. So and a retired landscaper decides not to retire, but go home and make the world a beautiful place before he dies. And I operate on him. I couldn't cure him. He lived to over 90 with no sign of cancer, making the world beautiful. So I'd say again, how can you contribute love to the world? Love yourself, love your body, and love the other people. They're wounded too. Thornton Wilder said a wonderful sentence, that in love service, only the wounded soldier can serve, because an angel refuses to heal a doctor. And he shares that with him. So share your wounds and help others to heal, and you will feel better too.
Well, you know, you taught me a valuable lesson when you reviewed my book, and that was to talk about the lessons learned. And that's what we can all pass on to the world.
Right.
I think that it's so important to not just focus on the story itself, but to reveal the lessons learned, because that can speak to people and give them hope that they too can recover from whatever ailment they have.
Yeah.
And we have run out of time. It went quickly.
Let me
conclude
with that sentence. You know, we all need mottos to live by, and we're all going to run out of time someday. So I always say, enjoy the time you have.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Oh,
I really
pleasure,
appreciate
David.
It.
Okay.
All right, Bernie. You take good care and give my regards to your family.
Thank you.
Once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.